Welcome. I'm Kevin Miller, and this podcast is called Self-Helpful because not all self-help is helpful. I'm your curator, critic, and translator of the best and brightest minds in the self-help world today. How to de-roll from your daily roles. Even if we are being authentic, we often put on a different face for the roles we have in life. I'd like to think I'm the same guy all the time, but how I interact with my 10-year-old daughter is different from how I interact with a podcast guest, for instance. I mean, I'm still me, but I have different expectations and engage from different orientations based on who I'm in front of. And sometimes we can struggle to switch gears. This is my part two session, Values, Motives, and Habits with Vienna Farron, licensed marriage and family therapist, one of New York City's most sought after relationship therapists, and now author of her first book, The Origins of You, How Breaking Family Patterns Can Liberate the Way We Live and Love. That was part one together. Vienna has nearly 700,000 followers tuning in on Instagram to find their authentic selves. And it's in the beginning topic in this episode of Spirituality where Vienna discusses her efforts to de-roll in her life, a concept I've not heard defined quite like this before. You're also going to hear a special insert in this episode, as at the end of the show, Vienna asked to share something else that greatly altered her spiritual life. And I actually had it clipped out of the end and brought back up to the beginning where we talked about spirituality. And the story is the death of her dog and holding him as he took his last breath. She shares how it shifted her relationship with death and made it less scary. I was really honored Vienna was moved enough to share this with us. Honestly, her candor and relatability touched me a lot. She really engaged in our conversation much more like a patient than a counselor. And I felt I was talking just with a friend. And I'd say this is why she has such a massive following of people who feel the same. Other highlights that you'll hear as we walk through this regarding relationships, Vienna works to accept limitations and strengths in her relationships. With health and wellness, she says for her, movement is like salve. I appreciate that and relate to that. Mind and mental health are her profession. And she shares that she learned to like alone time because she was a single child. Yet she also shares she's an introvert. And I press in as to which she gives more credit to. I thought it was interesting. Regarding wanting alone time, is it a bit of a nature versus nurture discussion that we got into? And with work and career, Vienna said she loves being in meaningful conversations with people. And with money and finances, she shares how her relationship with money has changed throughout her life. And she makes a quip that I found really interesting and asked her to explain when she said, wounds and gifts are neighbors. You'll hear that and more coming up. The Self-Helpful Podcast was founded by the Zig Ziglar Corporation. If you are a coach or consultant and want to add credibility, clients, and impact to your business, go to Ziglar.com. This podcast, friends, exists to help you find and understand the guidance and counsel that will help you elevate your personal experience of life and the way you show up for others. Following these sponsors who help make the show possible and provide great resources for your life, I bring you Vienna Farron and a walk through her values, motives, and habits. Her book again is The Origins of You, How Breaking Family Patterns Can Liberate the Way We Live and Love. And you can find her on Instagram at MindfulMFT, as in marriage and family therapy, MindfulMFT. Well, Vienna, I almost ended our last discussion together on a very spiritual place, on quoting some of the Bible out of there, and you as a therapist. You know what? I'll start right there, because I had Tama Bryant on the show about a year ago, who at the time was president-elect of the APA. I think she's now official, you know, president. And that's part of her platform, is bringing spirituality into psychology, into therapy, you know, somewhat. So I'm always curious as where that falls in your own life, the spiritual aspect. Mm-hmm. Tell me about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a big part. And Yeah, to always, obviously, when I'm in working with clients, I'm meeting people where they're at. Right? And I think the role of therapist is to not put any of your stuff on those who are in front of you, and to really kind of understand the way in which people, you know, see the world, relate to themselves, relate to God, relate to universe, etc. But yeah, the spiritual space is a really important one for me. And I've had, there's different ways in which I can connect with that. I think this was off mic before, but you had mentioned flow state earlier, mm-hmm. Which, yeah, that's one of the ways in which there is just a deeper connection to everything that is around and within. I grew up as an athlete and always found that when I got into that space, right, that was a place where my mind could kind of shut off, you know, all the thinking parts. And I think anybody who's maybe gotten into that space before knows, like, there's this deep sense of presence that comes when you are just in flow. And I think for many of us, that happens in nature. My husband and I used to live in New York City. We now live in upstate New York on, you know, a number of acres. And to just even exist in nature and not have any noise pollution, right? It's like that, you know, kind of brings you to, again, something bigger than you. And the same with moving my body. I played a lot of sports. I played lacrosse in college. I never officially, but loved boxing, and, you know, would find myself in particular boxing workouts where I was just in, you know, tapped into it. And then, have you talked much about psychedelics on your show before, or has that been a,
no, I've had the request to, you know, to get some, like, I'm a Michael Pollan fan, and that's a big part of him. And even recently, I think I've been seeing, Dr. Mark Hyman, who we're supposed to be having mm-hmm. on the show, talking about it as well, but no, please.
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, I obviously will say, you know, this needs to be sort of an intentional thing. And with anything that we do, I think the setting and, you know, who's around you and what the support looks like is very important. It's funny. I have never done any drugs in my entire life, up until the point where I took mushrooms as an adult. And I had drank at times before too, but prior, like, never smoked weed, never dabbled in anything. And that might've been because I was an athlete and, you know, that it was just not part of my world. But, when the first time that I took mushrooms, psilocybin, right, it was like, you know, really opened me up and connected me to source in a way that I had never been connected to before. And yeah, it's one of those things that I think is hard to necessarily put into words, but I've had a number of experiences. Again, I've not gone on that many journeys, you know, under 10 in my lifetime, but a number of journeys that have been incredibly revealing and opening for me, as well as being pregnant and bringing a little one into the world. You know, you think about the different experiences in which it just kind of expands and opens you up to the sacredness of, and oh my gosh, just the, like, the magic of, right? The things that, yeah, that can be hard to put into words. I don't know for you. I know you mentioned, do you have 3 children or you have more than 3? You said up at that point you had
9, actually.
Okay. So yeah, you might be familiar with the birthing process and, you know, sort of like these moments in life that bring you to this space that is just so much bigger than anything that our brains can wrap themselves around.
So is there, so for you on a, whether it's daily or weekly or whatever, what are some, consistent practices or ways that you use to try to step into that space?
Yeah. So movement is so important for me. I try to move as much as I can throughout the week, whether, whatever that workout might look like, going for walks, without devices. So like all the distractions away, because I have a little one in my life, I love going for, his name is Code. I love going for code-led walks, which is, I think Montessori-esque, but, this idea of, you know, not going at my pace, but going at your pace, in which you show me all of the things that I would 100% miss if I was walking my adult self around. Right. And so like the, again, the magic and beauty of being at the level and pace of a tiny human, I think as many people say, you know, how much playfulness and joy comes into our lives when we are around little humans in the world, you know, it's like that, that is something that is so special, but I try to get out into nature. Even if it's just, even in a busy day, like to just walk outside and touch the tree. And, you know, we've got little nooks on our land where we can go and just sit. Sitting with tea. I don't know if you've ever done tea ceremonies before. I am a big senses person. What that means to me is I connect to things through intentional sense. So smell, sound, touch. Right. So what music I put on and get very intentional with that. What scent I, maybe if I'm lighting Palo Santo in the home or something like that, that again is something that shifts something significantly for me, and to sit in that, right? Yeah. To whether it's a meditation, but like something very intentional about being with that. I remember when, this is a little bit less now, but when I was, when we were living in the city and I was going into work every day into the office, now I get to see a lot of clients virtually, but this idea of walking like this, what did I call it? Oh gosh, it's so funny. This is my term and I've forgotten it, but maybe it'll come back to me. But this, de-rolling. So as I walk into the apartment from the outside noise and the outside chaos and all of that, right? It's like, okay, the scent goes on, the changing of the clothes goes on, off and then on, the sound goes on, and the role of being out in the world, being therapist, you know, this identity, right? Is this shift into how I'm going to exist now. And so even though it's a little bit different because I don't have to, you know, enter, exit, and I'm not maybe as effective by, you know, the noise and the people and all of that, it's still very important for me on a daily practice to have those pieces there for me. You know, some of the routines, honestly, whether it's the way in which I, as simple as the way in which I make my coffee in the morning, right? Like there's a lot of pieces to it. Go figure. I mean, I think a lot, you know, somebody who takes something like that so seriously, right? There's like a number of pieces in it that is very supportive for me. Breath work. My husband does, he really can't get me into that cold plunge, I gotta say. Every once in a while, but you know, it's those are the things I think on the daily connection, you know, sometimes you don't have to have, I listen to people who are like, I journal for an hour, then I sit in meditation for an hour, then I do that, you know, and honestly, let me just poke a hole in that for some of us. Like, I think sometimes it's really in this day-to-day stuff that is more accessible, but when we do it distracted, it's not as meaningful as it could be. It's not as sacred as it could be, right? So like going for the walk, but well, if you're on your phone the entire time, yeah, that's a really different experience. Playing with your children and, you know, but being distracted because the television is on, it's a really different experience. Doing your coffee, but not being intentional with it, right, is like, that's a very different experience. So I think one of the things is about actually being deeply connected to the things that you're doing and eliminating the distractions so that you can feel and connect and experience, you know, the magic and the sacredness that I think kind of exists in everything.
You use the word sacredness. So we are very kindred spirits in what you talked about. And as much as I like spontaneity and I don't like confines and I don't like, I don't like confines. So even schedules and whatever, I tend to kick against. It was my brother who, by the way, very, very into psychedelics and journeys. That's a big part of his life. But he brought it to me. He was actually talking about both of us. He says, yeah, we're both really appreciate our rituals. And I hadn't thought about that, that I am very like that ritualistic in my coffee, in my tea, in my wine and dinner, in my music. And even that, I live out in the country like you do, but I come in from the house, take my shoes and socks off and put my feet. We have a concrete floor that's just a couple inches above dirt. So it's a grounding and just, so I appreciate that. So, but you put in that word sacred. I like the sacredness and the rituals and kind of honoring that thing we're doing instead of just rolling through it, which is hard for me sometimes with some of the movement stuff. I'm thinking of performance over that. So you said your kid's name is Code?
Code.
Spell that.
C-O-D-E.
That's interesting. We have I have one, Nekoda, N-E-K-O-D-A. We call him Coda. So I was just, interesting. Well, you were going to say something about the sacred and the ritual.
That sometimes we overthink it, that sometimes we try to do so much, right? That sometimes it like, and I was saying it before, but I hear stories from people, oh, I feel so guilty that I don't do all these things. We have all the, oh, do this, do that, do this, do that. These are all the things that are so good. We know that this is great for us. We know that this is good for us. And it's like, I think there is something about just looking at what your life is and how can you do it more tuned in, you know?
Yeah.
Right. More, like more instead present, of... Yeah. Right. More present, right? To allow for, you know, what if you just looked outside for 5 minutes and tried to notice something that you haven't noticed before? What if you went for a walk and listened for 10 different sounds?
Yeah.
Like, what would you find? What would you see? What would you come in contact with? Right. So instead of, you know, great, if all of that stuff works for people, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. But I guess I'd rather speak to the person who's like, I don't know. You know, like, I don't know. I don't want to journal for 30 minutes every day. Or I don't want to do, you know, it's like, okay, so what are you doing already that you could be more present to?
I really like your term of de-rolling. Getting out of those roles. I think that's something I appreciate, but I haven't really defined and solidified. So I'll be thinking on that. Thank you for that.
Can I say one more thing please about your first question?
Yes.
I forgot to share this. A few, maybe 6-ish weeks after Code was born, my golden retriever, whom I had for about 12 years, he passed away, and he was diagnosed with cancer a couple of weeks before Code was born. And they said that he had a few days and he wound up extending it a bit. We didn't, no surgery or anything, that we did. We just sort of let him have his kind of natural ending. And he had asked me about spirituality at the beginning and being present for, his name is Bronx, being present for Bronx's death was one of the most meaningful and spiritual experiences of my life. And he died at home naturally. And I remember, you know, there were a lot of lessons that were coming up, and Bronx getting cancer really out of nowhere. I had been super healthy before that, just kind of came in, and then it was like, all right, it's going to be over. And it was like, whoa, this is shocking. And wait, this feels particularly cruel because I'm bringing my firstborn into the world simultaneously. And like, wait, what's happening? And all of that. And then finally kind of let go of control. And I remember the morning, there were a couple of times where we thought it was going to be the last day, and he bounced back a bit, and he was so funny in his final days. He had such humor. And in the final morning, Connor, my husband's laying with him, and he calls to me and he's like, "V, I think he's going to be going now, if you want to come over." And so, we had some support in the house. So I left Code and went and laid with Bronx, and it was forehead to forehead with him. And Connor had his head on his chest where he's listening to his heart. And, you know, we're breathing with him, and animals know how to die. You know, he didn't really need any support from us, but we were there, and it was just the most beautiful experience ever. I mean, it was so painful to lose him, but to be present for his death and to have this takeaway of, like, I remember afterwards saying, I hope that everybody dies the way that Bronx died, feeling loved and held and welcomed back, you know, buddy, we, you know, in whatever form you want to come back into this family, like, we've got a spot for you. We love you. You know, you've been such a good dog, and right, all of this. And I just remember just being in this space, and he took two final breaths. I think the one, maybe when his soul left, and, you know, the last was just his final breath. And, we just arched his neck one way, and I thought that was it. And then he arched it one more back. And then, you know, that was when his heart stopped, and we sat there with him. And, you know, I have had people die in my life before, but I've never been there for the final breath. You know, I'd never been holding someone. I know this is an animal, and but, you know, for those of you who have dogs, you understand how much they're a part of your family, and how meaningful they are, even though they're not, you know, a human being. But I just remember, like, my relationship to death shifting. And that felt so important for me. There was something about it in that space that just made it so much less scary. You know, it was like, I think, as Stephen Jenkinson says, you know, we are a death phobic, grief phobic society. Yeah. And there was something about that experience is like, this is beautiful. This is beautiful. And I wanted to share that just because it really shifted my relationship to death. And I think that takeaway of, like, I hope that everybody can die this way. And I know that people will not. I know that not everybody will be held, that their last experience here is not going to be, I am so loved, I am so held, I am so worthy.
Thank you for that. Relationships is the next one. And I've got something from our past conversation I wanted to bring up, but I'll start there. First off, relationships. When you look at relationships, which, my gosh, is the core of, you know, even of your book, it's the origins of you to understand you, relationship with self, and then forward with others. So this is part of your profession right here, but I'll pose a question to you on relationships. What are the values that rise to the surface when I pose that question?
Integrity. Yeah. I mean, I think everything kind of falls underneath that then, right? It's like, I'm like, you know, trustworthiness, but that's part of integrity. You know, all of the things are a part of integrity. That is a huge pillar in my life. And I think professionally, personally, it's the number one place that I exist. I think authenticity, funny enough, that we've been like, how do we define it? What does it mean? But
I was going to ask that in integrity, we can kind of hold together, can't we?
Yeah. You know, I think what I hear from people, and it is true. It's like, no matter where you see me or find me, and this is who I am, this is what you get. in my therapy sessions, outside with friends, like, no, there's no persona that gets put on, you know, this is it. And I like the idea of showing up the same way, you know. Sure, might I have some more energy for something, might, you know, yes, of course, but it's like, no, at the core, this is Vienna. And the idea that people know who I am because of that feels good.
When we fast, we stop eating food and allow our body to repair. The research on the benefits and the reset is profound. The problem is, we like food. We're addicted to food. Me too. Missing a meal or a day of eating is terrifying to a lot of people. So here is ProLawn. It's a revolutionary plant-based nutrition program that nourishes the body while making the cells believe they're fasting. ProLawn is not a diet. It's science based on Nobel Prize-winning discoveries in medicine. ProLawn provides a five-day program where you get snacks and soups and beverages all designed to keep your body in a fasting state while taking away the difficulty and mindset of deprivation. I've fasted for 5 days with nothing but water, and my physical and mental state was incredible. My struggle was just wanting to fulfill my habit of eating. It was significant. ProLawn took that away. It's amazing. I feel like I'm cheating, but getting the benefits of fasting. So right now, ProLawn is offering What Drives You listeners 10% off their 5-day nutrition program. So go to ProLawnLife.com/Kevin. That's ProLawnLife.com/Kevin for the special offer. Thankfully, the days of building a business website, then having this massive endeavor to integrate an online store are gone. Today, Shopify has fixed all that. I had one business where we actually built the entire website on Shopify's platform. So whether you're just starting out or you're selling $1 million of product already, Shopify is just the industry leader. It works the same for physical products or online and digital, and Shopify is just hands down the best out there. Most importantly, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. It's 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Getting people to buy is not that hard, at least to the buying point, but getting them to actually give their payment info is, and Shopify is king in that department. They also have top tier customer service, which I think is critical. You can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Kevin. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/Kevin to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/Kevin. Isn't that a part of the back to our discussion on grappling with authenticity? Mm-hmm. As you saying, again, back to that quote of love can be unconditional, but for relationships, doesn't need to have conditions. Mm-hmm. Your word, I appreciate using persona, that we are talking mm-hmm. about that I'm going to be authentic. I'm not going to put on a mask or a persona, mm-hmm. even as I honor some conditions relationally that may be different.
Yes.
According to different people's boundaries, whatnot in there. But that feels like a good aspect of authenticity.
And I also get to choose what I feel is appropriate to reveal to.
Fair.
Right? Like, yeah. I don't need to reveal every part of myself to everyone.
Yeah.
So first off, we don't do that in therapy anyway. I don't operate as a blank slate therapist, but I'm a very big believer that if you're self-disclosing when you're on the other side of the mountain, right? Meaning like I don't self-disclose if I'm in a mess of something, right? I don't need anybody else's. It is not my client's responsibility to care for me, even though I know they care about me as a human being, of course, but it is not their responsibility to care for me. That's not the role. And so, you know, of course, to speak, not everybody who's listening is a therapist, but across the board, we don't have to share everything that's happening in our lives with everyone. Part of what I'm talking about is discernment, right? And discernment doesn't equate to inauthenticity. To me, it's wisdom. You know, to me, it's like, yeah. Oh, I know where sharing this goes with you. I have history, I have data points, I have evidence here. And I think especially oftentimes in the, intimate relationships, again, sometimes with our, parents as we are adults, it's sort of this like, oh, I wish that you could understand it, or I'm hoping for a different, experience with you. And I think there's this line between when hopefulness is something that is expansive and saves us sometimes even, versus when it gets to a place where it is just our suffering.
Gosh,
When,
that's fair.
yeah, right. And so again, discernment becomes such an important skill set in order to be able to decide with whom, in what setting, when, right? What is this in service of? You're not inauthentic just because you intentionally choose not to share something.
Now, I appreciate that. To choose not to share something or choose to serve or step out in a way that could come off as performing and say, no, I'm just caring for the other person. I've seen people grapple with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I would say that it's more about caring for yourself, or at least in the way that I'm thinking about it. So let me be really explicitly clear. I'm not suggesting that, okay, it is not inauthentic for you to withhold something that is going to affect somebody else, right? If you're like, oh, I am being unfaithful and I've listened to this show and now I've gotten the okay to not share information and that that can still mean that I am authentic. Okay? So I want to be clear in the way that we're describing this. What the way that I'm thinking about it is, okay, I discernment is about knowing the difference between whether this is sharing this information is going to lead us to something that is connected, healthy, important, valuable, healing, et cetera, versus I know where this goes and it's about me. It's not about you. Right. Like I want to share something about myself, but I'm going to choose with whom I do that.
Is it fair to say in the relationship to have the perspective of sharing what is going to mutually serve? It's going to serve both of us. If it's just about me, then I got to own up. If it's just about me, it may not serve them well. And in honoring the relationship,
So for example, what's a good example that I can use? There are things that I might not share with my mom or my dad because it will have us go on a merry-go-round. And I don't need to go on the merry-go-round with them anymore.
Well, would you say it's going to hit unresolved aspects that they have?
And that's my perspective of it.
Sure.
But again, it's the ability to say, I don't, I, at this point in my life, my healing journey has taken me to a place where I don't need to go on the merry-go-round
Well,
with you
could I
anymore.
turn that my question around too? I could say that, you know what, I'm not going to enter that into that with them because, or with so and so, because I know I have unresolution in that. So, yeah, that's fair.
But it doesn't mean that I'm going to turn away from whatever that your resolution is, right? Like, I think part of this is about knowing, okay, there is a dead end here. And I think many of us know that with certain people in our lives, right? It's like, this isn't changeable, right? This is not going to shift. And so can I get to a place where I can accept what the limitations are, what the constraints are? Right. Instead of trying to jump back on this merry-go-round and find a different outcome, this conversation all started with authenticity, right? And so it's to say that we can still remain authentic kind of revealed to ourselves or revealed to some of the important people in our lives. Like, I would share that with my partner, knowing that we can have an entirely different conversation about whatever insecurity or thing or whatever it is that might be presenting. But to know that it's not going to go anywhere productive in certain dynamics is a place where I put a pattern down instead of picking the pattern up.
Goodness. Well, it reminds me too, then, even of the aspect of there are things that I may not share with my wife, not even from any unresolution, but because it's not relevant for me to try to relate to her as a as a father. Let's talk about what it's like to be a father, or for her to try to relate about childbirth. I was even there, but I've just never grown a kid in my belly. I mean, I can't do that. So thank goodness that is why we have other people. There's somebody I have coming on the show talking about that, about the need for other relationships in our life so that we don't end up looking for any one person, specifically a spouse or significant other, to be the end all for everything. Cause it's impossible. Right. We need other people. They can't relate. So on that, on an aspect of this, I thought of this on the first part of the show and wanted to ask, this has got to be, well, I was gonna say daunting. I guess it's daunting to me. I won't put that on you. You're a parent now. Mm-hmm. So as you look at this, the profound nature of the operate, you can't not give your kid an operating system.
Right.
It's got to, I mean, I haven't conceived of it maybe to this degree and with this defined, but realizing, man, I can't not be programming and influencing, like I talked about first time, you know, brainwashing my kids. And I feel like, gosh, I'm going to do my best. And now the saving grace or the redemption is, especially to get older, I can just let them know, guys, I'm brainwashed. I can't not. Let's just get that out on the table that you are. We've got to get you some other experiences. We've got to get you talking with other people. We've got to get you understand. Well, or is it just that a big push? Would that be where you would say with your kid to help them be as self-aware as possible?
Yeah. Yeah. And we know for sure, for certain, that we are imperfect and flawed, and we're going to create an environment that misses the mark sometimes. Yeah. I think overall, we're probably in a pretty decent place as parents go, but it is not beyond us that we will let him down and we will say things or do things that, you know, get internalized by him in a particular way. And now that I've, you know, written the book and I've got those five wounds, you know, people are like, what origin wound do you think Code's going to have? You know, yeah. Yeah, right. Like it's real and that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, that's okay. I think as parents, we do everything in our power to protect them from the big stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we really want to try to shield them from, you know, the big T trauma stuff. Yeah. And we also know that they are here to have a story. You know, if they grew up in a vacuum in which they never had to resolve anything in life, like, I'm not quite sure what the point is.
True.
You know, like there is a need to be able to claim something for yourself, right? To turn towards, to be with the pain, to heal. You know, like that's the beauty. You know, when we think like, why are we here? You know, I think we all know it's not to go to the 9 to 5 and, you know, do all that stuff, right? Like, what's the point of being here? And I don't know. I would say it's to heal, you know, and maybe there's much more to it, but on a very, you know, simple, basic level, right? It's like, it's to heal. It's to come into contact with our pain and to find a way to resolve it for ourselves so that we get to choose differently. And yeah, it's a big responsibility, obviously, as a parent. And I think one of the things that feels important, knowing that we will misstep, of course, is to acknowledge and own it when we realize, you know, to be able to hold the space to honor what his experiences are and to acknowledge and take accountability once once we can.
Yeah.
You know, when I talk to, I work with adult children is what I say, right?
That's,
yeah. Right? And what every adult child, you know, has ever said to me is that from a heartfelt place, right, is to be acknowledged by a parent is, you know, something that we crave. We don't want it if it's not, if there's going to be excuses or explanations or this, that, and the other. But when a parent can get to a heartfelt place, no matter what the age is, right? It's, and you don't, it doesn't require you to be in relationship with them. You don't have to reconcile in some particular way, but to be seen, heard, and understood at the end of the day is what we want.
You know, we were, my book's coming out soon, and
yeah.
I was grateful to have incredible endorsements by, you know, incredibly accomplished people. But the one that stood out, my dad's, you know, the affirmation and that he got.
Wow.
And I was just watching it and so aware that that was so significant. You know, you're mentioning a minute ago that isn't part of the point of life to heal. Reminds me of something that impacted me so much. The author Donald Miller wrote a book, A Million Miles in 1,000 Years. And in that, he's talking about what makes a good story. And not a good story like to impress others, but to fulfill us. And he says, it's a character who wants something and overcomes conflict to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And you bring me that we're going to have, if we do anything of value, mm-hmm. it's going to have conflict in it. If we have a childhood of value, it's going to have conflict in it. And it is then the overcoming of that, the healing, as you say, that we mm-hmm. find, yeah, the meaning and purpose. That's good. That's deep water. Health and wellness is the next mm-hmm. category here. Obviously you talked about your, affinity mm-hmm. for movement. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned cross country skiing as an analogy earlier. Is that something you do?
I haven't skied in a while. I grew up skiing for sure.
Yeah.
But it's, no, I haven't been out on the skis in a number of years.
Yeah.
So, but it's funny. I just had the conversation last night. It's like, you know, we need to prioritize getting back out there. We were married in Whistler, BC. I'm like, we have to, we've got to make this a priority. So, I tore my ACL, had a baby, was pregnant, you know, all the things. It's like, there's this chapter, I feel like, where you're like, oh, nope, it's not here. And, now got to get back in there. But yes, movement is the salve, and it always has been. And it was one of the places, you know, previously I was naturally good at sports. I worked at it too. But it came naturally for me, and it was a place where I could go when there was all the chaos and pain. Right. And it was a place where I could avoid it, you know, and I spent a lot of time there. I also got validation from it, right? Because I was good at whatever sport I, you know, was generally doing, but, it was something that helped me, I think, during a time where my emotional experience was overlooked.
I'm going to ask a question in regards to you as a therapist in the aspect of health that you may even prescribe in mm-hmm. movement, because mm-hmm. it does to me, you said a salve, and I've always said, you know, for better and worse, it's my main medication is getting mm-hmm. out into the woods and making an effort, expending myself to a degree. It's just, I probably erred on the side of addiction to that at mm-hmm. some points,
mm-hmm.
but what place do you have a place for that in your therapy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so when I was in grad school, one of the things in one area of the community care was I asked if it was okay if I could run with my clients and run and then have our session immediately following. And I got the okay on it. I always like to think a little bit outside of the box, as outside of the traditional environment setting for therapy. And I remember there was like one particular client at the time who was a runner, and he had gotten a scholarship to run in university, but then lost the scholarship because of drug use. And we were working through some stuff, and we had a great relationship, but there was something about, it's like, do you want to run together? And I saw his face light up. And I was like, listen, you're going to have to go slow because you're going to leave me in the dust for sure. But do you want to go for a run together and have our session? I was at Northwestern in Chicago or Evanston. And like, we'll just go sit by the lake halfway through and have a session on a rock. And then we'll run back. He's like, yeah, let's do it. I was like, okay. And I started to do that a little bit more. And I saw, you know, that, well, one, I think the shared commitment of, you know, going through the thing together is something that is very bonding, uniting. But there was something that I noticed that allowed people to come closer to their emotional experiences once there had been movement prior. And fast forward, you know, I'm now based in upstate New York, but I still do a lot of this in the city, and that's where it was generated as well, is that I would do workshops with workout classes. Wow. So we would have, you know, the hour workout, and then immediately following that, I would give a workshop in which I would be asking people to process through the stuff that came up, you know. And I have loved using movement, of course, for myself. Whenever I have a big decision or whenever I feel stuck, movement first, right? That's that helps.
So
what
are your go-tos today? Is running, is that top of the list?
No, I don't love running. Oh, okay. not as much anymore, but cycling, Peloton, I can get on there and do that. The class is which is specific, it's a digital platform, but they're based in New York City and LA. Boxing, again, whenever I can get my lacrosse stick out, even wall ball is what we call it.
Yeah.
And just like getting my stick and a ball and just the, you know, over and over and over and over. And that's the thing, right? When you're, I got to focus on the ball. I can't really think about anything else right now. Yeah. It's just to be there for, as an adult, not because I'm trying to improve my stick skills at this point of my life. You know, it's like, no, this is about therapy, right? This is about presence, right? This is about being right here with this ball and connecting with it. Right. And what else? Pilates. Yeah. I mean, hiking.
Yeah.
We're up here now. So hiking, walking, all of that. But I try to push competitively, at least on the bike.
Friends, I'm pretty candid about my lack of financial prowess. Money and numbers are fairly Greek to me, so I need a lot of guidance. One of my closest friends is a wildly successful wealth manager, and I'm working on some financial literacy and just continually seeking guidance. So I ask you to check out yahoofinance.com. Nobody knows it all, and Yahoo Finance is an incredible resource for the rookies like me or the seasoned investors. You know, before my dad passed away recently, Dave Ramsey and his wife Sharon flew down to visit. We all got to spend a day together, and I was at yahoofinance.com just now. I saw multiple news flashes from Dave and other people that you respect, and they're hitting so many of the hottest areas in finance today. So it's a place to get a snapshot of all aspects of your financial interests, and if you have them, your portfolios. I hadn't realized Yahoo Finance is the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. So for your comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. One more time. yahoofinance.com. You talked about, or you mentioned earlier, breath work. Is that a mm-hmm. something that you've been instilling into the health and wellness routine?
Yeah, it's definitely not something that I do every day. I can notice myself having resistance to it. Of course, you know, it's like, I think part of this is the awareness of when you're like, nope, I'm going to resist this, or this feels uncomfortable for me. I have a husband who likes to lead me through breath work. And so, yeah, when I do it, it is really powerful. And I guess I'm thinking of it more on the grander scale when I'm setting aside quite a bit of time, but like box breathing, I do every day, multiple times a day, you know, where it's like, you don't even realize it. Yeah. Like it doesn't almost feel as intentional as setting aside 30 minutes to be led. But now, you know, speaking to the parenting side, we're doing it with Code. Right. He's two, but it's like, and not, he's obviously not counting, you know, the box, but to just breathe in and breathe out. And it's so adorable because the moment we go breathe through your nose and we do the big breath in, and then he stops crying or he stops having the emotional big, kind of the big emotions, and then out through your mouth. And he does it. He goes, and it's like, it's immediate, right? And so it's so special to see these tools that work even when they don't necessarily have the full understanding of what's going on. But yeah, so some of the smaller stuff, yes, on the daily, and then some of the bigger ones less frequently. But
man, the box breathing, that's become my go-to when I realize constantly that my shoulders are up. And I'm just breathing shallow and I may be excited, you know, it's just, it's not bad, but and then sit there and do that. Tell me about nutrition on the nutrition side, anything that you specific that you adhere to there?
Yeah, I think a lot shifted during COVID, honestly, because we went from eating out quite a bit, or, you know, having food delivered, New York City, you know, sort of the culture there, to cooking everything. And I noticed a huge shift during that time. It was like the consistency, the predictability for my body, and how much I've been dairy free for a really long time. Even just noticing, I think as I age, I notice certain reactions to things formerly that wouldn't affect me. Like now I know that I have gluten issues. It doesn't mean that I never partake in gluten, but like I'll get kind of a rash around my eyes and it's like, oh yeah, the body just lets you know if you're willing to listen to it, you know? And so anyway, my point is we pretty much cook every meal and we eat cleanly and our bodies thank us for it. And, you know, it's, you can feel the difference so significantly. It's automatic. Even when we eat out at a good restaurant, you know, it's like, it doesn't matter. My stomach doesn't manage it as well as it does when I'm cooking at home and when it knows what it's going to get. And it's just pretty incredible to just see how the body responds to it and how it communicates and all of that. And so, we've been thinking about doing years ago, I went and got tested and I had candida, a yeast buildup, and I went on a candida cleanse and 45 days. Oh my gosh, it was hard. I made Connor do it with me because I was like, there is no way that I make it through this. If you are sitting next to me snacking on something, like I cannot do this unless you're doing it with me. And he did it. And honestly, within 2 weeks, what the doctor had said at the time was that you are only operating at 50% max capacity. And I felt that shift happen about 2 weeks in, where even though it was hard and even though she certainly had cravings for things here and there, all of a sudden my whole being was...
I'm a foodie and I enjoy learning about the process that brings great foods and beverages from idea to the table. And then I like tasting them and learning the nuances
of what creates the most significant tastes, from coffee to cheese to distilled beverages. I did a tequila tasting in Mexico, and recently bourbon, Heaven Hill Bottled in Bond Bourbon. It really impressed me from the story to the taste. I grew up in Kentucky, where horse racing and bourbon are famous, and I got introduced to Heaven Hill Bottled in Bond Bourbon. It's produced by Heaven Hill Distillery, which has been and still remains family-owned since 1935, and I'm impressed with the bourbon's ultra-rich, smooth taste, and right on the bottle, it states that this bourbon is 7 years old, which is actually three times longer than what's required to be certified as bottled in bond. I feel with beverages, the longer the prep, the better the taste. Being a bottled in bond product means it must pass a list of 7 requirements that set the standard for this quality bourbon. So look for it at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely and drink wisely.
What's the best way to describe it? Like, it wasn't like I was buzzing, but it was like
energized.
I wasn't tired. I wasn't struggling. It was none of that. I felt really at peace, in my entire body. So we've been thinking about doing something like that again, but, we eat well. And I think that there's been a real shift in the predictability and consistency of the foods that we put into our bodies.
I'm big on wearable devices now. And I recently got a new Garmin. I use it for my cycling and running and stuff, but it has a body battery, thing on it. I didn't have that on my last one. And I can watch my food intake. I mean, of course, stress and other things can affect it, but especially looking at my food intake. And yesterday, it's interesting you're saying that. Yesterday, I had total paleo day. No sugar, no carbs, really, no alcohol. And my body battery this morning says 100%. I've never hit 100%.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It's amazing, right? When you have something that tracks that and shows you what a significant impact it has on you. And to, maybe that's not going to be your every day, but to give yourself that, did you watch Limitless on Disney Plus?
Yeah.
Right. Like the episode around fasting and, obviously.
That was the last one we watched just recently.
Okay. Yeah. So I think he did a 4-day fast. Maybe we watched it a while ago.
Yeah, it was three or four.
Yeah. 3 or 4 days, which obviously, that's significant. You got to set up your week appropriately in order to, get through something like that. But I think they were saying to do a day fast quarterly, that really just resets everything for you. And so maybe that's your next challenge.
My buddy's a doc and a functional medicine doc. So we've actually done that. I do one probably every quarter.
Yeah.
And then I did do a 5-day fast.
Wow.
And it was an experience. It was I had been working up to it, so it wasn't super hard. But
that's good.
Part of you've talked a lot. I mean, the next category here is mind and mental health. And you've talked about some of those things that you do already as far as getting out and kind of grounding yourself and de-rolling. And I love these things. And of course, your life is about mind and mental health. I'm usually curious with therapists specifically of where do you, looking at your own mental state, and where are you, where do you need to advocate for yourself? Where are you most at risk of getting derailed?
Yeah, I think where I'm most at risk now is community. Meaning we moved, our community is really spread out, and we've been in this conversation about where we really want to settle in, and we don't have a ton of community up where we live. We love where we live. We love our home. We love our, the property that we have here. The land is so beautiful. It's very nourishing. And we're without community here. And that's been a hard thing for both of us. And, we're thinking maybe we'll have another child here soon. And, we're not going to do that without community around. We know how hard, Code was born during pandemic too. So there were layers of it where I think it was dialed up, right? Of we didn't have people coming over to visit us in part because, it was the pandemic. And so, I think community support is so important to us. We have such amazing people in our lives, but because they're in different places, you know, we don't get the benefit of that. And there's been times where we've spent a month with, you know, a number of friends in a location, and that has been the most fulfilling and, you know, expansive experiences for us. And I think finding that place is the next thing on the list of to-dos, because we are relational. I mean, human, we are relational beings. Connor and I are being connected in our relationships matters. It's right at the top of the list. And when we can't see the people that we love on a consistent basis, you know, that is challenging for us. And so, yeah, I think that if we were to not prioritize that, that would be very challenging for us to kind of continue on the way that we're doing it.
Well, and I'm going to guess, I mean, I don't have to guess. I mean, we know that, you know, diseases of despair are ever increasing. And I tend to, I know there's a lot that we can attribute it to. So I'll ask you, but I tend to look at, even though we are, you know, uber connected, you know, in quotes, shallowly, that we are less deeply connected, and that people's feelings of isolation and being alone have got to be top of the list for this increase in apathy and depression.
Absolutely. We know that isolation is the killer. And, you know, and so in response to that, right, it is connection, it is community, it's, you know, it's closeness, it's intimacy, right? It's all of those things. And, you know, we do a decent job of, you know, maintaining great relationships with people. But I think, again, we're getting to that point in life where we want to be around the people we love and who love us. And, my husband is Canadian, so all of his family's there. It's like, yeah, we just kind of exist in this space where we have people who come to us from time to time, certainly, but we don't, we're not in the village, you know. Maybe you said that on the other the other session, but and that's something that we want.
Where do you, are there places, again, kind of like we talked about with exercise, or places where you daily set aside just for your mental wellness? What do you do there?
Yeah, well, it's certainly a little more challenging with that kiddo running around, but yeah, like once he, you know, in the mornings, we're very lucky to have a child who sleeps until about 7:30 right now. It's not too early of a rise, so we get that little nook.
You said
in
2 years old? That's pretty good.
So we've got a little nook in the morning, and then he goes to bed around 7:30-ish as well, and that time afterwards. And so, yeah, morning rituals that we talked about before, really important. The Connor and I will generally carve out a time in the day where one of us will go work out, so we can get that piece. I don't know if I mentioned this on the other, I'm an only child. I might've said that kind of in passing. So, you know, I grew up, with myself. I like my alone time a lot. I love being connected to other people too, but I really like my alone time. And that is important for me. And so whether that's going for a solo walk sometimes, obviously I've repeated it now endless times about, you know, working out and carving out some of that for myself, taking a bath, and, you know, just being very intentional with some type of a ritual or caretaking experience for me that feels important. You know, it's like trying to get those into the day, at least one of those things into the day where I just get a little bit of Vienna time, but also where my partner and I get couple time too. You know, I think when you're navigating individual, couple, and family, you know, it's really hard sometimes to juggle. And you might be able to speak to the challenge of this even more with 9 kiddos, right? Of like, where does the individual fit in there? Where does the couple fit in, you know, when we're prioritizing family or connection with, you know, with children, and knowing how important that is. But I've always said that, you know, the family is only as strong as the couple is only as strong as the individual, right? It's like in the system, right, rises from the individual, right? How healthy I am as an individual will play into how healthy we are as a couple, how healthy we are as a family. And so that reminder of what do I need, Vienna, in order to be well, you know? And for me, it's like, some of it is the self-care kind of quiet, but sometimes it's like, babe, I have to go into the city. Like I need a time with my friends there. Or I want to go see a show, or I want to go to this event with somebody I find super interesting, like to make sure that I am still honoring my ability, my desire to toggle between these different worlds. Yeah. That's been a really important thing for me. Connor could never go back to Manhattan and be happy. But for me, I do love aspects of New York City. I also love aspects of nature and the calm and what we have. But in being honest with what it is that I need to feel alive and to feel inspired, yeah. You know, I get a lot of inspiration from that. And even though we might have some differences with it, it's like making sure that, but both of us are, I think you use the word advocating for at some point, but like to advocate yeah. for, this is what I need for me to feel satiated.
And we're back to the self-love aspect yeah. of, you know, loving others as we love ourselves, if we love ourselves. I'm interested in you mentioning being an only child and liking your alone time. How does that's a different direction into it as opposed to saying, mm-hmm. oh, I'm an introvert, extrovert. Mm-hmm. How do you fit that in there?
I am introverted. Okay. And I can, how would I say? I'm probably on a cusp at times, but I do restore by being with myself quite yeah. a bit. I can restore by being with others if it feels authentic.
There's my rub. And I was actually, I had another therapist on one time and I was sharing about the social things that I can, mm-hmm. I can do well in, I can mm-hmm. function well in, but they drain me. And I mentioned being an introvert and he took me to task a little bit. It was, mm-hmm. Dr. Benjamin Hardy took me to task a little bit and really brought out that also mm-hmm. I tend to not be authentic. I perform mm-hmm. kind of, I do put on, mm-hmm. I don't know. Somewhat, maybe I don't know if I want to say a persona, but I don't. Mm-hmm. I'm a people pleaser, and so it's mm-hmm. I don't know how to turn that off somewhat
yeah.
As well. But I do. Back to you know, I don't know. Is it my programming or is it just me? But I right. do feel like I need that alone time. But sometimes, even reading your book, I'm thinking, gosh, but how much of that sometimes is I need the alone time because I just need to avoid all the stuff, the drama.
Yeah. That. But I think the question is like, what's the fear? What happens if I don't perform in this setting?
Yeah.
Right. Like what happens yeah. if I don't please in this setting?
Yeah.
Right. And I think, you know, on my side, I feel depleted when it does, when it feels performative from other people, or it feels like kind of surface level, like that is not fulfilling for me. That yeah. is not a good exchange of my time. I would rather than be with myself, but when it's nourishing connection, experiences, conversations with people, that feels generating and restorative yeah. for me. But I think that question is a really important one. You, the listener, right, is like, what am I afraid happens if I am not on, right? If I'm not performing, and we're not talking about you presenting on stage or something like that. Right. Like, of course, there's a job to do if that's right. the case. But when it's just like you with people at a cocktail party or some event that's not about you, right? It's like, yeah, like who am I if I'm not performing and what's the story? Mm. Right.
That's interesting. Yeah. I still have work to do there. Back to reading in your book about I don't know if you use these words, caretaking of other people's mm-hmm. emotions. I want them to feel good so that I feel good mm-hmm. and I get caught in that, especially in a group setting, which is different than this. I'm not doing that here at all. And this yeah. is not draining. This is almost no. a flow state, honestly, mm-hmm. of having this conversation, but that's interesting. I have a brother 7 years younger, sister 10 years. So I was more an only child. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting mm-hmm. too. I hadn't thought about that I got used to mm-hmm. my alone time there. In addition, maybe to being a little introverted. Well, right. the next one here is work and career and business. And I will ask your values there, because I assume you're in, or you could be in, a time of shift, transition, whatnot. You've been therapist, you've been, you know, doing social media, like we talked about. You've got, you know, whatever it is, 600,000-700,000 people on Instagram following you. But I assume you've been primarily the role of therapist. Now you are author. With a book that's selling incredibly well. And with that come, and now you're doing this, you're doing, you know, guesting, and probably getting lots of other opportunities as well. I would assume it is bringing you to a place, which is where a lot of my guests are, of kind of looking at, okay, what do I value here? Cause there's a lot going on.
Yeah. That's right. And I still get a good giggle out of the title of author. People are like, you're an author. I'm like, no. They're like, no, literally, you're an author. I'm like, okay, yeah, that's I got to embody that.
Book in hand with your name on it. Right
there. That's it. I'm an author. There's transition. You know, again, coming back to the thing, the work that is most meaningful to me, and I love working with people. And you know, when I said integrity before, that's a huge pillar for the work side, of course, too. And that to me means not leaving behind something for something that's shinier, almost, right? Like, okay. When I sit and think, what do I actually love doing day in, day out? It's being in conversation with people, period. Will I write another book at some point? Maybe, you know, but I wrote that book while seeing clients. I'm having these interviews and I have a full week of clients, you know, that I haven't had to shift away from seeing my clients. That hasn't been something that's gotten in the way. And I don't know that I would take on anything unless I entered into a new chapter in my life in which that felt aligned, where I would stop seeing clients, because clients, they get all the credit. They're the credit. You know, I can't do anything that I do without them. I can't do anything that I do without them. I can't write a great book without them. I can't learn without them, right? Like, I get to be in the real life experiences and stories of people who generously and bravely and vulnerably share their lives with me. This is the greatest education of my life. And so everything that I get to say and do, and, you know, it comes from that. And without it, I don't really know what there is. I mean, research, sure, that doesn't sound super compelling to me. It's like being with humans is the research for me. You know, like, I've worked now, gosh, I've been saying 20,000 hours for years now. So probably many more thousands than that, where I've worked with individuals, couples, and families face to face, you know, over these last 15 plus years now. And when you do this work, you can't talk about it without being in it. Yeah. I mean, you can try, plenty of people try, but you can't talk to the human experience if you're not in contact with many, many different types of human experiences. And like you said, when you're talking about your kids, where you're like, you're brainwashed, you got to talk to new people, you got to get new with this, that, right? If I am giving quote unquote advice about how to have healthy relationships based on my singular experience, even if it works for me, right? That is so limited. So the gift of being in conversation with people who have entirely different stories, entirely different complexity, entirely different family systems, entirely different pain, right? Helps me be able to communicate this message to the world in a way that generally will land with most people.
Well, thanks.
If they allow it.
Yeah. Thanks for that. No, it's great. I love the paradigm. Actually, I'm thinking about that. That's what I think. I'm thankful for people like you. That's why, it's the only reason I get to sit here and do this. And that's what my book came out of. And gosh, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. I'll share this, because this is something I struggle with, is you know, when I was in Chicago, Evanston for grad school, and then I moved back east and started working in Manhattan. And there was something about making it in New York City, you know, that felt important in those early years. And obviously I was young. I was 23 at the time when I was in New York starting my career there. And yeah, I made it, you know, I created a lot from there, and that city didn't break me.
Yeah.
I found a way, you know, to do something that I wanted to and to become successful there. And that, I think for a period of time, that was a badge of honor. You know, I think for a lot of people who have spent some time in New York City, it's like that can feel like if you made it in New York City, you can make it anywhere, right? Yeah. It's like sort of that mantra that a lot of New Yorkers have. And I feel confronted by the idea, you know, we've sort of the little stepping stone, we're upstate New York now, but still have my office in the city, still go in for events, you know, still can touch it. And I feel confronted by the idea of going further away from it, and like existing in this work without that badge in some ways, you know, and it's not figured out. It's a little messy, but you know, as we think about, I said, oh, what I know to be true is what at the top of the list is community. It's being around the people we love, and that's not, you know, I have many people I love there, but that's not a workable place for us as a family for a number of reasons. And okay, so what happens, right, when I know that this is true and this is so important to me, and simultaneously this like, I'm moving away from the city that gave me so many opportunities. I'm so grateful to it. And I feel proud of what I accomplished there. And can I still be this somewhere that's quite a bit quieter?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And yeah, so again, it's a question that I'm sitting with and reflecting on, and I don't have the answers to it all right now. I'll let you know when I do. But yeah, when it comes to work, you know, it's a question that I'm holding for myself right now. Well, yeah.
Thanks for the candor.
Yeah.
I think a lot of folks will relate to that. And a piece of that, when you were talking about work, is money. That's the next one. Money, finances, wealth. Where would you say your values are as you look at, money?
Relationship to money has shifted so much over the years. I grew up with a father who was like pretty middle upper class, right? Or sorry, upper middle class. I think that's the right way to say it. Nothing fancy, but like decently well off. And then my mom was kind of poverty line, honestly, and very different ways of existing and living in the world. And I grew up, I was living with my mom for, you know, the majority of my childhood. And then I started living with my dad, I think maybe in like seventh or eighth grade, I made a decision to leave. And I remember when I started really thinking about my relationship to money, part of what drove it, drove the desire to make money, to be independently financially successful, was the fear of existing in the world in the way that my mom did. It was hard because as they were going through this divorce and she had nothing and he had enough, he had plenty, right? It's like I saw what that looked like. And what that looked like was really scary to me. It was like, I cannot be in a position where someone or something outside of me has control or power over me, right? It's like, I need to be powerful. I cannot be helpless. I cannot be powerless. And so, you know, it was motivated and driven from a fear-based place for a really long time. And, you know, in the book, I share something that a colleague of mine says, which is, that our wounds and our gifts are next door neighbors.
Wounds and our gifts. Yeah.
Right. Like when people are like, well, I wouldn't be who, I wouldn't be who I am today without the story.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, that is very true. I believe that to be true. It's like, you know, I am a phenomenal therapist because I, you know, at least one part of it is because I figure I can track a story. I don't forget a single detail because I grew up with manipulation and gaslighting around me. So like there's the pain and then here's the gift. And there's a point though, coming back to that wise, mature adult self, right, where the motivation doesn't need to come from the pain anymore.
Right.
So part of my motivation for becoming kind of independently financially successful was driven by this fear, by this pain of what I saw and what I experienced and what I believed to be true. And what that, you know, I'm a hard worker. I've always been a hard worker. I'm determined. But sometimes I don't know where to stop. And, you know, when I was just building my practice at the beginning, you know, I was working 6 different gigs and, you know, I gave a lot to it, but I start working at 6 a.m. and stop working at midnight. And, you know, and okay, it set me up well, but it also meant that I missed out on a lot of things that I, you know, probably didn't need to miss out on at the time. But again, was just generated and being driven by this fear until I really came to understand what the motivator was. And I needed to be able to shift that, which, you know, maybe not shockingly, the moment I shift, even more abundance came. Hmm. Right. When it's like, it doesn't need to be driven by the pain anymore, the fear anymore. It's like, I can choose how I want to relate to money and I can continue to want to have financial success. And, you know, I think really what was tied to that was stability, and, you know, safety and consistency. And, but I can do that from a place of healing around that, you know, and yeah, it's,
line again, gifts and whatever
are married. That our wounds and our gifts or that our pain and our gifts are our next door neighbors, Dr. Alexander Solomon.
You know, endurance and no excuses, no limits it was awesome as an athlete. You know that it served me so well. Gets applause out there in the world.
Oh yeah.
It was the bane of relationships. Mm-hmm. It still is. I don't want to, I don't want to go in and fix and dig in. Mm-hmm. I would just, can we just endure it? And man, that, and so yeah, honoring that the wounds and the gifts are neighbors is that's stout. That's
And I think what, you know, speaking, cause we were talking about the high performers and the achievers before, I think sometimes the fear of looking at our pain is really the fear of losing our edge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And this idea, and, you know, I work with athletes and other, you know, high performers, high achievers, but, you know, I think this idea that just because you are looking or addressing something or healing something doesn't have to mean that you're losing your edge. Sometimes we're so motivated by the dark, you know, by the pain, like whatever inner critic or whatever we say to
I'm gonna prove them wrong. Yeah.
Sure. Or like whatever it is you need to say to pedal faster, you know, or like whatever. It's like, I think that's the trouble, is that we know that we can get those outcomes with in different ways. You ever watch basketball, college basketball?
No, not really.
All right. So you might not know, but like the different types of coaches, right? I remember the Bobby Knights of the world, sure. Right? Where it's like throwing chairs on the court, screaming at people in their faces, you know, versus the coaches who are just kind and
I grew up
thoughtful,
on football, like, so it was, you know, Tom Landry with Dallas, man. Okay. The guy was the most stoic person on the planet. Never an emotion. Totally opposite. Uh-huh.
Right. And it's like, you can see that you can achieve either way.
Yeah.
Right. You can have great teams or get great athletes to get to this certain point, but what path are you taking? Yeah. And I think it's a really good analogy, right, to just think about, like, yeah, you can still win a championship, even if you're not screaming at yourself. You know, you can still become successful in whatever, you know, definition it, that is for you, without needing to hold and cling to your pain. Right. And that was true for me when it came to money. Right. It's like I said, when I started to resolve that and not be motivated by the fear, more abundance came.
It's big. This last category here is, and I feel like you've just naturally tapped on a lot of it, but the things you do that gives you energy. But I generally wrap this, I've been trying to wrap this around somewhat non-productive things, the things that you do that's not, because I mean, your work inspires you and gives your energy and, you know, writing and being a parent, granted, but the things that you go out here and do, like you talked about, sometimes I got to get in the city, see a show or whatever. It's not going to increase your profession, or it doesn't build, create something. It's something that you're just doing because this energizes me, kind of like you talked about the alone time that you said it somewhat in my paraphrasing, you know, to make Vienna the best Vienna she can be. So any activities, interests, hobbies, something that fall in that line?
Yeah. I mean, being with my son is a huge one. There's nothing that that does for me. I mean, maybe it helps me connect to other people who have children and, you know, understand their stories a little bit differently. But to just like being present with him and playing with him and like watching his cute little like mannerisms and little personality emerge and the funny things that he does, like that energizes and is so nourishing and fulfilling. Great conversations with people. It's hard when it's like, it's almost like everything that exists does play into my work in some way, but it's not for it. You know, it's not intentionally like, ooh, what am I going to get from this that's going to support me professionally, right? It's like, I am so fulfilled and nourished through deep conversation. Love, intimacy, right? It's like when I say intimacy, I mean going innermost with myself and going innermost with others. And when I get, and that's, you know, certainly part of conversation and connection, but when we get to exist in that space, that feels so rewarding. Like having reflections, that's energizing, right? In some ways, like, not because I need to, this is why, or now I'm connecting every dot, but there's something about reflections and introspection that when something clicks in and you're like, oh, that's that opening for change. You know, that's so inspiring and invigorating. Wonder and awe, you know, just seeing the beauty of the world and, yeah, traveling, new experiences, all of that is so generative for me. If we can resolve, you know, if we can face, if we can do these things, then we begin to shift these relationships in some level where, you know, as we transition, like maybe that can be our experience. And so, yeah, just wanted to share that here.
Thank you. I feel honored that you would share that. I'm grateful for your, I'm not surprised that you're successful as a therapist with your heart and depth and insight. Thank you for bringing it here. Thank you for bringing it to me. I get to be the first and most beneficiary of that, but I'm so grateful to bring this message and you to everyone. Vienna, thank you. Thanks for the time. And yeah, just your heart and investment in this time with me. I'm incredibly grateful, forever grateful. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
This episode was just truly a gift to me. Again, Vienna Farren's book is called The Origins of You, How Breaking Family Patterns Can Liberate the Way We Live and Love. And you can find her on Instagram at MindfulMFT. Folks, thank you for tuning into the Self-Helpful Podcast, where I strive to help you and me elevate our personal experience of life and the way we show up for others. Stay driven, my friends.